gentlemen are clad in blue velvet tuxedos for the Cut Print Film Podcast number 54. Here are your hosts, Jeff, Dave and Chris.
Greetings, true believers. Welcome to the Cut Print Film Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Chris Evangelista.
I'm Jeff Rollins, also one of your hosts.
I'm Dave Costell, and you're listening to episode 54.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I'm glad you remembered to say that, because I didn't. We are a film podcast. We talk about movies. We have a website. It's called cutprintfilm.com. You can go there for reviews, editorials, interviews, and more.
And why don't you do us a favor, and if you're listening to this on your Apple device, why not go to the iTunes store and give this podcast a 5-star rating?
Yes.
Say, boy, are those three handsome gentlemen, and they're so informed when they talk about films.
Please do.
They wear such nice shirts.
Well, they wouldn't know that, Dave.
Oh.
As far as anybody knows.
We'll start posting pictures of our shirts.
Just the shirts.
Well, that seems like a waste of everyone's time.
Do we want to ask people something, the audience at home?
Yes. Will you be our Valentine?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. We'd like to encourage everyone to write into the show,
right.
Email us.
Or you can tweet, whatever floats your boat.
Yeah, and ask us some questions about
Ding dong,
movies.
Who's that? It's the Cut Print Film mailman.
Ooh, that's right. If enough people send us tweets and emails, we can read them on air and have a bit of a dialogue with our listeners.
Right, it'll be like you're part of the show.
Yeah, so, ask us questions, request directors for our director series, and you can do that by tweeting at CutPrintFilm.
Yes.
Or email us info@cutprintfilm.com.
That's right.
And we might not get back to you lickety-split.
Ever.
Well, no.
No one will do it.
We certainly will get back to you, but you'll also get your email read on the show.
That's right.
We'll have a bit of a discussion. Right. And we'll even say your name and read out your address.
Yes.
This is the cover.
And your bank account number.
So be sure to include all of that information in your emails.
Include your social security number and your measurements.
But for now, we're taking your calls.
No,
this is not a live show, Dave. This is a podcast. It's recorded in advance.
Yes.
Steve in Fort Lauderdale, you're on.
We don't even have a phone down here.
What'd you guys think of Kumiko the Treasure Hunter?
Oh, was that Jimmy Stewart calling in from the past?
We're going to let you go, Zach, because your phone's breaking up.
That's not even the name you said. It was Steve.
Well, I don't even know where to go now. I'm beside myself with rage.
That was so poorly done. We're all stunned.
Well,
anyway.
Caller wanted to know about Kumiko the Treasure Hunter, a film that was released this week that Dave saw.
Yeah, that I saw. What a coincidence that he called in with that.
Yes. What a coincidence that Steve Zach asked that question.
I'm half tempted to leave the show.
Well, we get a lot of calls, and I know which one to go to. Just let's peel the curtain back a little bit.
All right.
Or pull the curtain. So, I don't know which one you do.
So, Dave, tell us about this film.
Okay, so Kumiko the Treasure Hunter is a movie about the urban legend of a Japanese woman who went searching for the money from Fargo.
Right. At the beginning of Fargo, there's a little text that says, this is a true story, which it's not.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that wasn't true. Apparently that hit the news and everybody ran wild with it.
Oh, what? The woman really didn't die?
She wasn't looking for the money.
Okay.
She was just committing suicide.
Oh, all right.
Getting as far away from Japan as possible.
Well, who can blame her?
And
Godzilla attacks there all the time.
Yes, it's terrible.
And I think she was like
Mothra, all those types of giant monsters.
Yes.
Why would you even live there anymore?
Just get out of Japan, please.
But she's painted as kind of an eccentric in the movie, so I think maybe she was like interested in Fargo and was like, fuck this, I'm getting out of here.
Yeah.
So how is the movie?
I initially thought it was a documentary.
Oh. Yeah,
so did I.
Yeah.
Until you just said that.
Yeah, it's not. It's a drama. Full drama, beautifully filmed drama, and it's filmed like it's filmed kind of like it takes place in the Fargo universe.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. In a similar way that the show does, but I will say that this movie does it better than the show.
Wow.
Because the first like 25 minutes takes place in Tokyo and it still feels like Fargo. And I don't know how they did that, but the parts in Tokyo feel a little more grounded. And the Zellner brothers, the two directors, I forget their first names. David Zellner and Nathan Zellner.
And Zellner, I guess. Like Mario.
They said that they wanted the weirder part of the movie. They wanted the United States to feel like the weirder, more fantastical part of the movie, and it totally does. But there's some elements, like in the Fargo, there's a really friendly cop who like kind of helps her out, and everyone in Minnesota just is helping this Japanese girl out. She's sick of working in an office, and one day she just gets up and leaves and goes looking for the money. It's never like expressly said if she really thinks the money is there or not in the movie. But you can kind of tell because people keep telling her that it's not real and she kind of like ignores them.
Is it depressing? Because in theory, this sounds like it would be depressing, but like the poster I saw was very whimsical looking, which doesn't really fit with
it's vector art.
Yes.
It's like an emo band t-shirt.
It's like an adventure tale, while also a very fun adventure tale that is also extremely depressing, but like inspiring at the same time. It's weird. I've never seen a movie that made me felt these conflicting emotions at the same time. Like the ending brought me to tears with how like sad and happy it made me at the same time. I didn't know how to react, and I was blown away by it. This Under the Skin last year, I'm going to say that this was like the first great movie I saw this year.
Nice. I definitely want to watch this.
I recommend it to everyone out there. I think it's on VOD. Is it?
I'm not sure.
Those Amplify movies usually go on VOD.
This I remember this premiered. I don't know if it premiered, but it was at the Philadelphia Film Festival.
And
I missed it. It was.
See, that's strange. Like it didn't even pop out to me there.
It did. It was on my list of movies I wanted to see, but it conflicted with another movie that I saw. Probably some piece of garbage like Glass Chin, starring Billy Crudup, however you pronounce that gentleman's name.
Starring Glass Joe from Mike Tyson's Punch
Out.
The lady from Pacific Rim plays Kumiko, Rinko Kikuchi, that's how you say her name. And she's very good in this.
She's a good actress. She was in The Brothers Bloom. That's the movie I'm thinking of.
Okay.
She was good in that. She was like the silent explosives expert.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. She is awesome in that. David Elric, this premiered at Sundance last year, and he called it one of the best films to ever premiere at Sundance.
Oh, great.
So that's like, that just shows how good of a movie this is.
Nice.
That's awesome.
So if you don't trust my opinion, trust David Elric, because he knows what he's talking about.
He gets paid to do that. So.
This just sounds interesting, and the fact that the Zellner brothers did it makes it even more interesting.
Yeah. The thing that I really liked about it is that at its core, it's like about like a cinephile trying to like connect with movies in a way that's impossible.
That's great.
And that for people like us, that's like the kind of message you want to see in a movie.
Yeah. This is not on VOD. This is a strictly limited release. So if you're near a major city, I'm sure you can catch it.
Right.
I think it's playing in Philadelphia.
It doesn't open in Philadelphia until April.
Okay. All right.
But it's playing in limited cities now.
It's probably in Branson, Missouri, and St. Petersburg, Florida.
And Russia, St. Petersburg, Russia.
Yes, naturally. this has been a weak release week for Hollywood.
There's not a lot of big movies. The Gunman came out. It bombed.
Yeah, and the big one this week was Divergent.
Oh, yeah, which we have a review of it, but none of us saw.
I'm sorry. It's called Insurgent.
Yes, get it
right,
the
Divergent
Jeff.
Series.
Yes.
Yeah. They all rhyme. I couldn't be bothered to care. So if you're looking for a good movie this week, you're definitely set going with an indie release rather than.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great week for indies.
An amazing week.
Right.
Yeah.
Which brings us to Spring, which is on VOD right now. So Spring, it's from Drafthouse Films. It's
boy,
from,
boy, boy, boy.
I don't know.
I don't know what that means, but all right. It's from directors Justin Benson and his directing partner Aaron Moorhead. They directed a horror film called Resolution, which is actually a really interesting small sort of horror film. There's only two characters in the whole movie, and I think it's on Netflix now, and I recommend just seeing that if you haven't seen it.
It's called Resolution?
Yeah.
Is Spring horror? Because I saw like the first 20 minutes of it, and there were no horror elements.
What makes Spring very interesting, it's a genre-bending, blending, whatever you want to say, sort of film where it's a romance with horror elements. I mean, this film is – it's heavily inspired by Richard Linklater's Before trilogy. And what was cool is over the weekend, Richard Linklater actually commented on the film and said it was like a great – just a great movie, and which kind of like – I don't know, it touched me a little bit that like he would just say that, because yeah. he's under no obligation to say that about this small, you know, independent film, but he said he liked the movie. But
yeah, that's awesome.
It's about this guy played by Lou Taylor Pucci, who mm-hmm. was in Thumbsucker. That's the only movie I've really yeah. seen him in. Actually, he was in the Evil Dead remake too.
Well, let's just say he was in Thumbsucker.
And he plays this guy. His only family were his mother and his father, and his father died of a heart attack, and then a few weeks or months later, his mother finds out she has cancer, and she dies. And he's basically going through this, you know, this change of life. He doesn't know what to do with his life. He's driftless, and he gets into a bar fight the night of his mother's funeral. And so basically, he has no reason to stick around, and you know, there's a chance he might get charged for the bar fight. Mm-hmm. So he finds an old passport in a drawer he never used, and he uses it. He goes off to Italy, and he's sort of just bumming around Italy, living in a hostel. You know, just drifting around, and he meets this girl played by Nadia Hilker is her name, and she's mysterious and gorgeous and European and smart. And
that means she's a vampire, right?
Yeah. She's not a vampire.
Damn,
she's a Frankenstein's monster.
Well, see, that's what makes this film interesting, because you get hints that this character, her name is Louise, the character, you get hints that there's something not quite right at her, and everything you're going to predict is incorrect. And there's even a scene in the film where he starts listing things he thinks he is, and he's like, "Are you a vampire?" And she's like, "No." And he's like, "Are you a zombie?" And I really like something like that. And it's just a really interesting. It's better than I thought it
is
was.
Is she a Brundlefly?
Yes,
perhaps?
Exactly. That's it.
That makes a lot of sense.
It's a movie that's better than I even thought it was after I watched it. I gave it a 7 initially, and then a few days later, I kept thinking about it, and the more I thought about it, the more I realized
it's an 11.
Yes,
quite a jump.
I bumped up to an 8, and it's a small movie. It's intimate, but it's really interesting. It's gorgeous looking.
Yeah,
for such a small budget film, there's a lot of they use drone photography.
That's really cool,
and it gives this film just like an extra something, because you know a lot of indie films don't have that, and yeah. There's just these scenes of like the drone camera just swooping over, you know, Italian countryside, and it's just gorgeous looking.
The Chappie cam?
Yes. Exactly. It's sentient.
Great. Thank you.
But and the romance that is between the two lead characters, it's really intelligently done. It's not a cheap movie romance. You know,
that's nice.
It takes its time to, you know, get, you know, make it seem believable.
I wanted to talk about you bumping the grade you gave this from a 7 to an 8.
Yeah, we wanted to talk about this. You're fired. You can't do it.
Well,
we just can't stand for this. A lot of times when we get these screeners, we have to get the review turned around really, really fast.
Right.
Sometimes most times it's like it's a day or two.
Yeah.
And a lot of times with a movie like Spring, that is not enough time for the film to actually resonate in your mind enough for you to, you know, accurately grade it. And that's just the way it is.
Yeah, it needs to like ferment for a little while.
And we're not saying that you know, our reviews are without any thought put into them, but we're saying that the way that the business...
We roll a dice.
Yeah.
Well, this was the first time I felt compelled to really do that. I tend to never do that, change the grade, but just,
we don't do it at all.
But yeah, but just something about this film, like the more I thought about it, the more I realized it's just really good. It just stuck with me.
I did it once in the other direction. Where sometimes because I can pipe things up too much in my head, and then
I mean, listen, we fucking own the site, people.
Yeah, so that's true. We are.
If you have a problem with it, tough cookies, we'll do what we want.
Yes, tough noogies. But yeah, and that's just the way things are. The studios, they don't want their films to be released too far in advance, so they give critics a screener, you know, the week of release, if you're lucky.
Or the weekend before, and sometimes they expire, and plus you have to watch 10 other movies for the same week.
So I just think it's interesting that when you get a movie that's as powerful as that it actually has to seep. It's a slow burn movie that has to like sink into your mind before you can really, really give it a good evaluation. And, you know, I think that's interesting that you went back and bumped it up a little bit because it deserved it.
It really did. It just, I don't know. I really recommend seeing it. I would describe this movie, it's a mix between the Linklater Before movies and an American Werewolf in London. So if you want to think of that, where
that sounds great.
That sort of comedy, horror, and romance all mushed together. It just, I don't know, it works much
better.
So
she's a werewolf?
No.
But werewoman.
Oh, okay.
Come on, Dave. Be PC. So yeah, Spring, it's available on VOD. It's playing in a few cities, so I recommend it. Go see it.
And with that, that's all the talk about topical films we have.
Yeah. Right. I went to the gunman screening, and then the projector broke, so we don't have a review of it.
There's no gunman talk.
No.
Jeff saw Seymour.
Yes, I did.
How is he?
Well, it came out last week, so it's completely irrelevant this week.
No, what did you see this week?
I saw La Sapienza and didn't review it at all.
What was the other? You reviewed something this week. The Good Times Are Killing Me.
Well, I've had enough.
What is it called?
That's not a movie at all.
Growing Up in Other Lies.
Yeah, I saw Growing Up in Other Lies, and it
Are killing me.
I don't know.
As I said, we've discussed all the topical movies that we need to talk about. This was not a good movie. It's not even worth discussing. Yeah. It stars Wyatt Cenac from The Daily Show, and it's just terrible. It's about four friends that go on a pilgrimage throughout every single block of Manhattan because one of their friends is leaving the city.
Oh, this sounds insufferable.
And he's an artist. He's a painter, so it's even worse.
It sounds like Entourage, but in New York.
It's very much like Entourage. These characters are all piles of garbage. Ugh. They're unlikable people. They don't even like one another, but it's treated as though they're these zany characters. It stinks.
I read your pool quote that was like they're assholes and they don't even realize it
It's a self-discovery movie about four assholes that don't realize they're assholes. It's horrible.
No thanks.
There's not a joke to be found. Wyatt Cenac, he's the only talented cast member of this film, and he's the worst character in the movie. It's terrible.
How's Wyatt Earp? Is he okay?
Wyatt Earp is he's long been dead.
Oh,
the flesh has rotted off his bones.
I thought maybe his ashes were blowing around New York in the film.
Now Wiley Burp from An American Tale 2, he's just fine because he's an animated character and therefore immortal.
And for the sake of synergy, he was voiced by Jimmy Stewart, who called in earlier.
Yes, that's correct.
And asked us a question.
From Florida, the Sunshine State.
Yes, and posed as Steve Zack. So there you have it.
Well,
we know exactly what we're doing here.
Now that everyone's lost, let's take a break.
Yeah, we'll be right back with some Blue Velvet talk after this.
Yes, David Lynch, Director Series, Episode 2, Blue Velvet.
Ah, come forth and let me tell you the tale of CutPrintFilm.com, a film review, editorial, and news website.
Have they got any loot there?
They do. Oh, I can't find it. Does anyone know where the loot is?
I have one right here.
CutPrint Film has a merry band of men.
Do they drop the beat?
Yes, they do! It includes More Like Radio, Joystick Jerks, and Anti-Fanboy. She always sounds like she's eating soup for a song. She always goes, mmm, yes. Give her songs.
She's having a delicious soup and sandwich.
that Panera.
His name was Dave
Costa.
Do you folks mind if I leave the room?
Jeff wants to go get one of those bread bowls. He heard it, Nia.
Because I like to eat my bread bowl from the bottom.
Well, I could
upward.
Have a soup, but I'd like it to be 10,000 calories. Can I have it in a bread bowl?
I like everything in a bread bowl.
We're sitting on the blue velvet couch for this episode.
I wish. It should be more comfy than these.
It's a
IKEA
sofa,
chairs.
Though.
Yes, we're sitting on the blue velvet Murphy bed. There's wires everywhere.
It's going to spring up into the closet at any moment.
So we are on episode 2 of our David Lynch director series.
Right. The director series, for those who don't know, but you should by now, is we pick a director, we pick 3 films, we talk about those films over 3 shows. Yeah. And as always, we encourage you to write in and tell us a director you want to see.
Yeah. So this week we're doing 1986's Blue Velvet.
Right.
And before I go any further, there's a wonderful piece of production I should play for you. I want you all to hear this. This is brand new.
Okay.
It's the Cut Print Film Director Series.
Action.
Directors!
Pass the popcorn. Put a piece in my mouth.
Every week, the piece
sounds
in my
familiar.
Mouth makes me
laugh. That's new? You're sure?
Just recorded it.
Oh, okay.
All right, so this Blue Velvet came out on the heels of Lynch's epic fail.
Yes.
Dune.
Oh, dude.
Way to throw shade, Jeff.
Yes, I sure did throw shade.
Here. GTFO.
Throw this noose around my neck. Okay, so Blue Velvet is a murder mystery, a sexy murder mystery.
Oh, yes.
And it stars Dennis Hopper, Laura Dern, Isabella Rossellini, Kyle MacLachlan, Kyle MacLachlan's chin, and Kyle MacLachlan's gold earring.
And Dean Stockwell. As
yes.
A man who sings into a light.
Yes, Al from Quantum Leap is in this.
He's so good in this.
Yes, he is. So let me read this plot synopsis. You guys can interrupt me at any point to make jokes or make insightful comments, which I'm sure you won't do that.
What about insightful jokes?
You could do that. You could do that.
What about completely unrelated jokes?
You will do that.
Yeah.
All right. So Jeffrey Beaumont, played by Kyle MacLachlan's earring.
Was it confusing to watch this movie because the main character had
Jeff.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't.
It doesn't happen to you?
I'm perfectly capable to separate reality from fiction.
Oh, okay.
You're not a demented person?
Right. No.
I'm just checking before we get in.
Let's start over, shall we? I'm 4 words in. Jeffrey Beaumont, played by Kyle MacLachlan, returns to his logging hometown of Lumberton from Oak Lake College after his father suffers a near fatal stroke.
Which is I love that scene.
It is.
He just,
it's horrifying.
He's watering the lawn and he just falls over, and then the dog is
biting the water spurting from the hose that's in his stroke hands.
It's a great scene because it perfectly illustrates what Lynch does really well, where it's disturbing but also funny at the same time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
love that.
And there's a lot of that in this film, a lot of it. While walking home from the hospital, Jeffrey cuts through a vacant lot and discovers a severed ear. And haven't we all been there?
I mean, yeah, well, freshman year of college.
Jeffrey takes the ear to police detective John Williams.
The composer.
Yes. famous composer John Williams.
While writing the Jaws theme.
Through whom he reacquaints with the detective's daughter, Sandy, played by Laura Dern. She tells him details about the ear case and a suspicious woman named Dorothy Valens, played by Isabella Rossellini, who may be connected to the case. Increasingly curious, Jeffrey enters Dorothy's apartment by posing as an exterminator, and while Dorothy is distracted by a man dressed in a yellow suit at her door, whom Jeffrey later refers to as the Yellow Man, Jeffrey steals her spare key.
It was actually the man in the yellow hat from the Curious George.
Yes, books. He had a tiny rhesus monkey with him, and I thought that was sort of unrelated to the rest of the film.
Very strange.
Jeffrey and Sandy attend Dorothy's nightclub act in which she sings Blue Velvet, and leave early so Jeffrey can sneak into her apartment while she's still at the club. He hurriedly hides in her closet when she returns home early. However, Dorothy, wielding a knife, discovers him and threatens to kill him. Believing his curiosity is merely sexual and aroused by his voyeurism, Dorothy makes Jeffrey undress at knife point and begins to fillet him. This says fillet him. I feel like that was an act, like just acting as though she's fellating.
Yeah.
I didn't take that as any type of penetration going on.
But
there.
I mean, haven't we all have been in this situation?
Absolutely. This is the story of America.
no comment.
We'll have to talk after the show, Dave. She begins to fellate him, says this synopsis, before their encounter is interrupted by a knock at the door. And here's when things get crazy.
Oh, yeah.
As if they weren't insane enough.
They get even more crazy.
Dorothy hides Jeffrey in the closet, and from there he witnesses the visitor, Frank Booth, played by the insane Dennis Hopper.
Who is phenomenal.
Yes,
God, he's incredible.
Yes, he is. and he watches Frank Booth inflict his bizarre sexual proclivities, which include inhaling an unidentified gas and dry humping Dorothy.
I believe it's helium. Nitrous oxide.
It is nitrous? Okay, I thought it might have been helium.
In the original script, Lynch wanted it to be helium, but Dennis Hopper, because he was so experienced with drugs, said, hey, let's make it nitrous.
Okay. Frank is
I thought it was Soylent Green.
That's not even a drug. It's a food. And it's fictional.
And it's also people. For anybody who has not seen that film, what ails you?
I know my drugs, guys.
Okay. All right. No arguments here.
Flintstones, vitamins, Benadryl.
With beta carotene. Frank is an extremely foul-mouthed, violent sociopath whose orgasmic climax is a fit of both pleasure and rage.
So he's like everyone on this show.
Yeah, I thought he was a nice, relatable guy.
He is.
Yeah, he reminded me of me.
He continually refers to Dorothy as mommy and to himself as both daddy and baby who, quote-unquote, want to fuck. Frank has kidnapped Dorothy's husband and son to force her to perform sexual favors.
And again, haven't we all been there?
Exactly.
I mean, this film, it's so relatable.
It's an everyman story. When Frank leaves, a sad and desperate Dorothy tries to seduce Jeffrey again and demands that he hit her. But when he refuses, she tells him to leave.
Did he just leave or did he do the deed? I didn't get that.
I think he left this time.
Yeah.
Who, Frank Booth?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he just comes in, does the nitrous.
Well, he fondles, he wants her to shove the blue velvet in his mouth.
It's a power thing, yeah. Is what this is.
Seemed anticlimactic to me.
It is literally. Jeffrey again visits Dorothy's apartment, and she tells him that although she knows nothing about him, she has been yearning for him. He attends another of Dorothy's performances at the club where she sings the exact same song.
Hey, man.
And at the club,
she wore blue.
And it's such a slowed down version of the song that it was driving me nuts.
She's Isabella Rossellini cannot sing at all. And there's actually a feature on the DVD where she just talks about how she knows what a terrible singer she is.
It's like a cold record player in space.
Yes.
Like,
yeah. That's an interesting.
She wore blue.
In space, even.
It's like Hal being shut down.
You know, there's that scene. There's a scene in Apollo 13 where, like, the tape player goes.
Oh, where it's bouncing around.
It's, like, really slow.
Man, the places your mind goes, Dave.
I'd like to put it in a separate place, maybe this jar, and then throw it down the sewer.
Yeah, throw it into the sea.
At the club, Jeffrey spots Frank in the audience fondling a piece of blue velvet fabric he cut from Dorothy's robe. Jeffrey follows Frank and spends the next few days spying on him. Shortly afterwards, the two men that Jeffrey calls the well-dressed man and the yellow man, who we saw earlier, exit an industrial building that Frank frequently goes to. Jeffrey concludes the men are criminal associates of Frank, and he immediately visits Dorothy again, and the two have sex. When he refuses to hit her, though, she pressures him, becoming more emotional. In a blind rage, he knocks her backward and is instantly horrified, but Dorothy derives pleasure from it. Afterward, Frank catches Dorothy and Jeffrey together and forces them both to accompany him to the apartment of Ben. And now here's when things get really insane.
This is probably my favorite scene in the film.
Ben, played by Dean Stockwell, his suave, dandy partner in crime.
Wearing makeup for some reason.
Yes, lots of it.
Well, yeah, not just like a normal amount of makeup.
And Ben is...
Wait, wasn't that like a bar called This Is It? Or was that just his apartment?
That was his apartment.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's where they're keeping Dorothy's son and
husband.
And husband, yeah. Ben lip syncs a performance of Roy Orbison's In Dreams, sending Frank into a maudlin sadness and then a rage. Frank takes Jeffrey to a lumberyard where he molests Dorothy, and Jeffrey stands up to Frank by punching him in the face. Frank's cronies drag Jeffrey out of the car, and Frank puts lipstick on and kisses Jeffrey.
This is the best scene in the movie.
Again, we've all been there.
Yeah, exactly.
This is
a typical Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, I did that before I came over today.
Kisses Jeffrey on the face, intimidates him, and then savagely beats him to the overture of, what was that song?
In My Dreams,
yeah,
I think?
In Dreams.
Yeah, In Dreams.
Jeffrey wakes the next day at the same place and walks home, overcome with guilt and despair. He goes to the police station where he notices that Sandy's father's partner is the yellow man.
Oh, shit.
We're tying up some loose ends here,
yes.
Something Lynch doesn't often do.
Like when we never found out who the elephant man really was.
They never took that mask off.
Maybe he's the yellow man.
The Yellowfin Man.
Oh,
right?
Okay, yeah.
Okay,
that's what I was getting at.
Okay, the Yellow Man is an officer named Lieutenant Detective Tom Gordon, played by Fred Pickler.
Fred Pickles.
Yes, old Frederick Pickles.
Who plays Detective Williams?
I have it in my notes. We'll get back to that.
Because he's not good.
No, he's not, but I think that might be intentional.
It's George Dickerson.
There it is.
Name.
Later at Sandy's home, her father is amazed by Jeffrey's story, but warns him to stop his amateur sleuthing, lest he endanger himself and the investigation. Jeffrey and Sandy go to a dance together and profess their love, only to be confronted by Sandy's boyfriend, who's wearing his high school Letterman jacket.
Yes.
Mike's pissed.
Yeah, Mike is not happy with this situation. A confrontation is averted when the group finds Dorothy Valance naked, battered, and distressed on Jeffrey's front lawn.
Which is a very upsetting scene.
Yes, it is. Barely conscious, Dorothy calls Jeffrey her lover, and thereby revealing her intimacy with Jeffrey, causing Sandy to become upset and slap Jeffrey, although she immediately forgives him in the next scene.
Well, who wouldn't?
Yeah, I know I would. Jeffrey insists on returning to Dorothy's apartment and tells Sandy to send the police there, including her father, immediately. At Dorothy's apartment, Jeffrey finds Dorothy's husband, played by Don Green, who is dead from a gunshot to the head and identifiable by his missing ear,
yes,
as well as the Yellow Man, who bears a gruesome head wound and appears to have suffered a crude lobotomy. I didn't know what the hell was happening.
Yeah, he's been turned into a zombie by lobotomy.
He's just standing there with a gun in his hand.
Well, that's similar to what Jeffrey Dahmer did to a lot of his victims, where he drilled into their heads and tried to make them into, you know, zombies, the old school zombies.
I'm assuming Ben did this.
It was either that or Frank Booth.
Yeah. When Jeffrey tries to leave, he sees the well-dressed man coming up the stairs and recognizes him as Frank in disguise. Jeffrey talks to Detective Williams over the Yellow Man's police radio, but lies about his location inside the apartment. And when Frank enters and brags about hearing Jeffrey's location over his own police radio, are you getting this, folks? he hides in the same closet in which he originally saw Dorothy Valance. Frank fires his gun sporadically, killing the Yellow
Man. Bang, bang, bang!
And when he opens the closet door, Jeffrey fatally shoots him through the head.
Yes.
And his brains explode everywhere.
Mm.
Detective Williams, gun drawn, enters after Sandy, by the way. His daughter enters the apartment first.
Well, she's the police chief, I believe.
And they see the scene, and Jeffrey and Sandy now go ahead with their relationship and note the unusual appearance of robins in their town.
Right, a deliberately fake-looking robin, yes, with a bug in its mouth shows up.
Boy, oh boy. A montage sequence ends the film, which shows Dorothy and her son reunited wearing a happy birthday cap.
Yeah, so it's a oddly happy ending for a insane movie.
Yes. So,
Blue Velvet, what did you cats think of Blue Velvet?
Okay. I watched this movie at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Which I would not recommend, but
no,
go ahead.
Yeah, don't do that. If you haven't seen Blue Velvet, I don't know why you would even have listened to that entire synopsis.
You're a lunatic, perhaps.
But don't watch it at 8 a.m. I liked this movie. I liked it a lot. I don't love it, but there's a lot to like about it. There's a lot to talk about it. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of moving parts.
Right.
And there's some great performances, and there's some really bizarre choices,
right,
in dialogue and screenplay and all that stuff. But yeah, overall, I liked it. Dave?
I like it. It's clunky.
See, I don't think it's clunky at all. I think anything you think is clunky is intentional. Go ahead. Sure.
It just opens poorly. Like, it doesn't feel... It feels very unnatural in the beginning.
That's the point.
Yeah, I agree with Chris.
It's a very surrealist sort of piece.
And I get that, but it's just like
I mean, there's literally a shot of a white picket fence. It's clearly supposed to be phony.
I understand that. Like a bit like Edward Scissorhands, how that's right. Surrealist. But
That's a very good comparison.
Yeah, and it just doesn't... It's something with the acting that's off early in the movie. Everyone just kind of starts talking to each other like... And I get that that's intentional, but it kind of throws me off. Like, feel realistic, and the dialogue's a little clunky early in it. But once Dennis Hopper shows up, it turns into a different animal.
But that's
of a
not
film.
Until an hour into the film.
Yeah, I know.
what I think makes the Dennis Hopper performance so memorable is the fact that everything before him showing up is so intentionally clunky. It's very like apple pie America,
well, yeah,
sort of thing.
That's what I was going to say. Everything up until Dennis Hopper shows up is this perverted but this wholesome but perverted 50s setting.
Right.
And as soon as Dennis Hopper comes in, he drags it right into the 80s and the depravity of a dirty, filthy city, whereas everything up until that point was this wholesome suburban town.
Right, because the movie exists in a sort of limbo because all the cars and the fashion, they're very 50s looking, but...
Frank Booth and Brad Dourif...
laughing his Chucky laugh.
Yes, his goofy suit sleeves pushed up tells you, hey, this is the 80s. It's like just crashing your car into a tree, and the tree is the 80s. That's what I got out of the Frank Booth appearance, how it's so abrupt. He just kicks the door open.
Right. Yeah.
What are you looking at, shithead? He calls her a shithead.
I love that. And even before he shows up, the Dorothy Valance character also, it's hinting.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole theme of this movie is, the things that are lurking underneath the veneer. I mean, there's literally a shot where...
In the opening scene.
Yeah, where he pans down to the grass and you see, like, hideous just bugs swarming.
Eating one another, crawling over one another. And that's... I mean, that's heavy-handed symbolism.
Yeah, it's very on the nose, but it works somehow.
Yeah, Lynch isn't really going for... this isn't Shakespeare where there's allegory after allegory.
No, David Lynch does not do subtle. He does very blunt, in-your-face, surrealist sort of things.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just something about... It was specifically that scene where he takes the ear to the detective.
And
detective,
I love that. It's so too like, funny.
Yep, that's a human ear, all right.
An ear.
That made me laugh so hard. And that was... I feel like that was intentional.
It's that thing, again, where it's Lynch finding humor in a... really upsetting situation.
But I completely understand
in retrospect, yeah. But while you're watching it for the first time, it's in like the first 15 minutes of the movie, you're watching?
Exactly.
It's like Leave It to Beaver, but
here comes Eddie Haskell. And Eddie Haskell has a pair of scissors and an ear in his hand.
Yeah. No, yeah, I definitely see what you're saying, yeah. But
this exactly right. You're not 15 minutes into the film and you're already saying, what am I watching? What is this? And can you imagine watching this in 1986?
Yeah, like I almost wish I could do that because it's kind of bastardized by everything that came before it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I feel like this kind of thing has been done a little better.
Now.
Yeah.
By what? Well, I
can't. I can't specifically say. But like,
I'd say the Coen brothers owe a lot to Lynch.
Yeah.
Even like I said, Edward Scissorhands, which dabbles in that.
I
like,
wouldn't say Edward Scissorhands does it better than this movie. That I mean,
I think it does that like fake
'50s sort of 50s retro
vibe.
Thing?
Yeah, a Maybe. Little better.
But the real question is: have you ever seen a chicken walk done this masterfully?
But sorry. That's what I do on all my first dates, the chicken walk.
Apparently, the chicken walk is a thing that Kyle MacLachlan, the actor, just does at random. And Lynch saw him do it and said, hey, could you do that in the movie? We just had this non sequitur of Kyle MacLachlan asking Laura Dern, hey, you want to see my chicken walk?
I love that. I love
it's
how
amazing.
It's even though it's weird, it's natural. Like
I don't hate it. Yeah, like I love these things.
That's
like,
a good
feels
way to
very,
talk about Lynch. I don't hate it. That's pretty apt.
It feels like a weird It's a Wonderful Life. Like that came up. That come up last week too.
It did.
Like
I mean, this is a very perverted It's Wonderful. Yeah. I love this movie. I think it's phenomenal.
I like much more about it than I don't like.
Okay.
Much more. I like this movie.
I don't know. This is – it's such a – especially for the – even in this era, but especially for 86, it's such a – it pushes so many buttons and envelopes.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a – I won't say a big movie, but it had a fair amount of funding. And for it to go into these – heavy. I mean, this movie has more, S&M in it than the 50 Shades of Grey adaptation. I mean, that's something remarkable that they were able to pull that off in this movie.
Yeah. I mean, I keep going back to the 1986 thing, but I can't imagine what it would be like to see this in 1986, because what could you compare this to?
Yeah, nothing.
Maybe some John Waters films?
Yeah, that's like the closest I could think of is that sort of John Waters campy, kitschy sort of
and
thing.
And it's such a divisive film, even now, but especially then. Siskel and Ebert were completely split on it,
right.
Where Siskel loved it, and Ebert completely missed the point because he's an idiot.
As much as I love Ebert, he does sometimes get things wrong. And
boy, oh boy, did he blow this.
One of the things he complained about was he hated the way Isabella Rossellini's character was treated in the film. But it's like, that's the point.
Yeah, because she's being he kept saying Isabella Rossellini is humiliated because she's there nude. And it's like, hey, Raj, are you aware that this is a movie and she's playing a character?
Right.
Raji baby.
And yeah, his thing was he thought David Lynch was unjustly like putting her through torments, you know, that she didn't want to be in. But if you watch, again, on the DVD, there's a bunch of interviews. There's a long documentary about the making of the film, and there's an interview with Isabella Rossellini, and she has clearly no problem with anything that happened in the movie. So.
Well, Ebert's whole take on this is so condescending to women.
It is.
He's acting as though he's this big brother.
Like White Knight thing.
Yeah.
I feel like
he's totally missing the point of this movie.
I just feel like that was something he eventually overcame. Like, I feel like that was his mindset then, because it was the 80s, and you know, things were still... People thought differently, and it was the 80s, and he had grown up in, like, you know, the 50s and stuff. So I feel like eventually he got over it, but yeah.
Which is funny, because it is like that same collision
there. It is, yeah.
The things that I did like that were wacky was like the scenes with like 40 people in a car, mm-hmm. in the one car, and you just like can't tell where anyone is in the car.
Yeah.
Those fucking driving scenes are funny as hell.
Oh, anything with Dennis Hopper in this film it's simultaneously hilarious and terrifying. It's an incredible performance.
Well, this is an endlessly quotable movie.
And almost all the quotes are the Frank Booth quotes.
But not even that. Even Jeffrey Beaumont, you want to see my chicken walk?
Yes.
That's cool. In the middle of the movie, he literally says, I'm in the middle of a mystery.
Right.
It's just things like that that make me appreciate this movie more than I dislike some
She's
of the
She's like, I can't tell if you're a pervert or a detective. Right. He's like, that's for me to know and you to find out.
Yeah, well, let me just say, Jeffrey Beaumont is a creep.
That's another thing I love about the film. I love that this main character is, you know, even though he looks wholesome, he's clearly not.
It's definitely made, I mean, I think it's even said point blank that he is like Frank Booth, and he comes out clean at the end of the film. But if he didn't, if it weren't for this detective helping him and Laura Dern's wholesome character helping him, he would come out the other end like Frank Booth, because he's already – there's a deleted scene where before he goes home after his father's stroke, he watches a rape occur and does nothing. He just watches because he's a voyeur.
Oh, okay.
And he enjoys watching crime. And I think that's another message in this film, because there's a scene where his aunt and his mother are watching, in the very beginning of the film, are watching a true crime show, but they're watching it as entertainment. So I think Lynch is saying a lot about entertainment in this town. Crime is entertainment because crime doesn't exist on this side of Lincoln Street.
Right.
And I think that's why the Jeffrey Beaumont character is hiding in the closet watching this – I'll call it a rape of Dorothy Valance.
Yeah, absolutely.
And doing nothing about it, because he enjoys it. As much as he is afraid of Frank Booth hurting him, he enjoys watching this stuff.
Right.
And he would become Frank Booth if it weren't for Laura Dern.
And what makes the Jeffrey Beaumont character more interesting to me is David Lynch has said the character is heavily inspired by himself. Like the way he dresses.
Yeah, I got that.
The way the character dresses.
He even looks like
Lynch. Yeah, the hairstyle.
Looks like he has that hard chin.
Yeah.
And Lynch... I mean, in Lost Highway, he cast Bill Pullman, who looks like Kyle MacLachlan, who looks like David Lynch. He likes – there's a lot of Lynch in Lynch's films.
Absolutely.
And I think this is a lot about his, you know, growing up in the suburbs, Midwest suburbs.
Yeah, he told a story about when he was a child, he and his brother were walking home from somewhere, and they just saw this naked woman sort of dazed and staggering through the street, and that stuck with him, and it ended up in this film because it just upset him so much. And another thing I loved, going back to the whole voyeuristic thing, even though Jeffrey is clearly a creep, what I loved is that the Sandy character, she's much more wholesome seeming, but she too
engages
in voyeurism.
Yeah.
I mean, she spies on her father's conversations to, you know, hear what he's saying and stuff like that. And I love that she's just as unwholesome as he is on some level.
But he takes it the next step further.
Right.
He's breaking into homes.
Yeah, he's getting worse and worse. But at the same time, she's also the one who sets him on this course.
That's true.
He wouldn't even begin.
Yeah, she's like the main motivator.
Yeah, he wouldn't be doing any of this if it weren't for her coming
to him. That's interesting that she's the motivator, and she's also the one that pulls him in off the ledge.
It's almost like she's sort of like using him to get her kicks in a way. That like because she clearly doesn't want to go breaking into houses, so right. She finds some guy. She literally just comes out of the darkness one night and is like, oh, hi.
You're right. She does come out of the darkness.
She comes out of the darkness into the light and just meets him on the street. And from there, she's setting him on this course of, you know, let's, you know, go break into this house for me and find it. And it's sort of like she's just using him in a way to do things for her.
That, like, darkness, that, like, aligns her with Frank a little bit.
Right.
Because every time the lights go low, he's like, oh, it's dark now. Yeah. Like, and that's when he goes into his crazy mode.
Yes. Yeah.
And God, those are some of the greatest scenes in this film. The Frank Booth character, he is just... Would you call him an id, just personified?
I don't even know, man.
I don't know.
He's just like...
I'm not sure what to really make of this character as a whole.
He's my hero.
I think the Frank Booth character is literally every dark, seedy thing in this town personified.
Yeah, he just hops from topic to topic.
Yeah, right. He's the walking personification of the dark underbelly of this town.
Right.
It's all just in one guy. And what makes this Dennis Hopper performance so great is Dennis Hopper had a long stint in drug rehab before this film, and he was sort of blacklisted.
Oh yeah, he was untouchable.
People didn't want to work with him anymore, and this was his comeback role, and he was completely sober playing this insane drugged up lunatic. And I just love that. I love that David Lynch gave Dennis Hopper his second chance playing this insane character.
Playing himself.
Yeah, right. Essentially. I mean, Hopper even said, I am Frank. I have to be this character.
Originally, David Lynch wanted to cast our piano player, Robert Loggia, in the part of Frank Booth.
And you know what? I really would have loved that.
Yeah,
that would have been incredible.
In Lost Highway, Robert Loggia plays a character who's very similar to this character.
Mr. Eddie.
It's not as insane, but it's clearly in the same mold.
Yeah.
And as great as Dennis Hopper is in this, I would like to see Robert Loggia.
I don't know. I think it's Dennis Hopper that brings the role to life, though. I think he's making creative decisions that
definitely
other people
would. Oh, yeah, you're absolutely
make.
Right.
It would definitely be a different character if Robert Loggia played or anyone else.
Just screaming everything.
I'm just saying I would like to see the Robert Loggia as Frank Booth. But as far as the film goes, I'm so happy. I wouldn't want it any other way than Dennis Hopper in this role.
In interviews, Dennis Hopper said he played this character he played it in the way that the best villains, they don't know they're villains. And
right.
He plays this character as he's someone who's just – he thinks he's legitimately in love with Darley Valens. And his love is so strong that he's willing to kidnap her husband and her son and cut his ear off.
Right,
so like,
yeah.
So like – and there's that great scene where Kyle MacLachlan's character sees – Frank Booth at the club, and he's watching Dorothy Valens sing, and he's like crying like a single tear.
Yeah,
and in Frank Booth's mind, he's like a noble guy, and everyone else sees what a lunatic he is.
I definitely got some sort of Oedipal complex thing here with Frank Booth calling Dorothy Valens mommy.
Oh yeah,
and referring to himself as daddy and baby, and then as the film ends. In the middle of the film, Jeffrey has sex with Dorothy Valens, and then he kills Frank Booth, who refers to himself as daddy. So do you think I'm crazy here?
His father being injured early in the movie kind of aligns with that, too.
Well, yeah, there was a feminist theorist. Her name was Laura Mulvey, and she argued that there's a metaphorical Oedipal family unit in the film with Jeffrey is the son, and then Frank and Dorothy
are the
parents.
I'm not just pulling things out of the air. Okay.
So, I mean, I agree that's absolutely there. I mean, Jeffrey's father is, you know, out of the picture. We never even see him again.
Yeah. As soon as I saw Frank Booth refer to himself as baby wanna fuck,
right.
He's calling Dorothy Valens mama or mommy. I thought there's something here with the Oedipus story.
No, absolutely, yeah.
What did Pauline Kael think of this?
She actually really liked this movie.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
When it came out...
I always go with the kale. That's my...
it's very healthy.
Yeah, I love kale chips.
Bake it in the oven. Set it to 350.
I was reading interviews and watching documentaries all weekend about this film, and in one of the documentaries, Dennis Hopper was saying...
Documentaries, quote unquote.
I don't know what you're implying.
You porn.
That's not at all. But
we all porn for you porn, right?
Dennis Hopper was saying when this came out, a lot of critics, they didn't know what the hell to make of this movie. And Pauline Kael was sort of like one of the champions of the film. She was saying, no, this is actually really brilliant. And a lot of critics at the time, they just took their cues from Pauline Kael. Mm-hmm. So
one of the things I liked about Lynch, and this is a thing that he does in a lot of films, he did it in The Elephant Man, is when he wants to show you, you know, like a dream sequence or just an artistic symbolism, he doesn't – there's no fades into it, and there's no blurriness to show this is a dream. He just – camera swoops over, and here's the shot he wants to show you, and then we're back to the story. Yeah. It's very matter of fact, and you can get confused because you can think, well, what the fuck was the point of that? Right. Because that looked like it was in the same room as all these other characters.
Yeah, I feel like that turns a lot of people off of Lynch's film because he's – exactly. He's not one of those directors who – lets you know what's real and what's not real.
Yeah, but it starts to make you question what's actually happening and what's not happening.
I mean, yeah, there's literally a scene where Frank Booth vanishes into thin air while laughing, which I love.
Well, the whole room of people vanishes.
That's
at one
true,
point.
Yeah. I mean, that whole the Dean Stockwell character, I mean, you see him once, you never see him again.
Is that the guy singing?
Yeah, he's the guy singing.
Yeah, that seems like...
It's like, who's to say that happened at all? I mean...
Yeah, that's true. I mean,
at the end, Jeffrey,
I subscribe to the fact that it did happen. That all,
but at the same
people,
time, like Jeffrey goes back to the apartment at the end. Where is that character? Yeah, like, why isn't he in his apartment singing into more microphones?
Yeah. That scene though is like one of the most striking scenes I've ever seen.
It's horrifying.
Like when Dennis Hopper's standing next to him, and it's framed with him standing there
singing into a garage light.
Right. Yeah. And then there's people behind him in like sitting on the couch. Right. It's just like something about it that
it's like weird obese women who are just there. Like, who are these people?
It was like almost like a painting. Like I would want that painted on my wall.
Yeah, it's like a Victorian.
Yeah, I guess maybe it has that like
it's kind of like
Barry Lyndon.
Yeah, I was
going
to say it's like Barry Lyndon. How every shot, like wide shot, is framed like that.
And it's so odd because it's in a filthy apartment.
It's cool that those two things can align with each other.
I really, really, really like Blue Velvet. I like the music choices in this. There's only four songs in the film, but they're all excellent. You have Blue Velvet, you have In Dreams. There's a song called Love Letters, which is really, really good. And am I forgetting the
There's a song that plays from time to time. It's this like sort of dreamy song.
I'll have a blue velvet.
I think you have Blue Velvet cupcakes.
Yeah,
they don't exist. It's red velvet.
All right,
come on, you ought to
put some sprinkles on that for me.
What I was getting to before Dave sang a Christmas song was that song. David Lynch actually wrote the lyrics for that for Angelo Badalamenti, the soundtrack guy.
Okay.
And to just play it throughout the film, which I kind of
like
that.
Yeah, but I did like again, these old-timey songs, these old rock and roll songs.
Yeah, it is cool.
Bluesy.
It's haunting.
Yeah, I mean, very haunting.
This whole movie is just – I equate this movie not in context or plot, but to me this is like Under the Skin, where it's that sort of just weird movie that's not like anything you've ever seen before, and it just sticks with you.
Yeah, this does stick with
like, you. I first saw this movie probably like at least 10 years ago, but – every scene sort of just burned itself into my mind. And I don't know. It's just a unique sort of experience.
I got to go watch it again. Like, I want to see it again. That's how it made me feel.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I've seen this probably a dozen times, and I always catch something new each time because it's so layered.
You know what it reminded me of? The Long Goodbye at parts. Like,
I mean, it has that noirish sort of.
Yeah, there's a noir tone.
But like that goofy noir. Like, it feels like. Weird.
Well, this is easily the blueprint for Twin Peaks. I mean, everything about this screams Twin Peaks. A show that, I'm not a big fan of.
Right.
But
well, the blueprint for Twin Peaks is very simple. It's just two triangles next to each other.
I saw where you were going. It was almost good.
Yeah. Sorry.
There's a lot about this. I mean, Kyle MacLachlan stars in Twin Peaks, but like I can just picture him pulling out a tape recorder and talking to Diane at any point during this film.
Yeah.
But even the fact that it takes place in a lumber town.
Right. Because I mean, it's very filled with Lynchian isms.
There's a murder.
Right.
There's these quirky characters acting as if as like no people you've ever interacted with before.
Right.
It's just – There's a lot of ideas from this that went into Twin Peaks, but I like this a whole lot more because I like a contained film rather than a series spread over.
You said something early on that there was a scene cut out where he's watching something weird happen.
A rape?
Yeah.
That weird thing.
Yes.
And that kind of explains some of the later scenes. So it felt like there was stuff cut out of this.
There's
like there was stuff missing.
There's a lot of cut scenes. A lot.
How long was the original cut? Do you know?
400 hours.
Oh, God.
No. Very long. That's not even... I don't think that's even possible.
Because this seems like one of those movies that would have been submitted as like 9 hours. And they're like, all right, Davey.
Yeah.
You got to give us something we can work with.
This is sheer conjecture, but I would say this is probably a 3-hour movie originally.
Okay.
Because there are so many cut scenes, so many. The Blu-ray DVD, the Blu-ray comes with, I think, a ton of cut scenes.
I just looked it up. Originally at running at nearly 4 hours.
Oh, man. All right. So I'm on to something there.
I was closer with 400.
But that's what it feels like. It feels like a movie where you're only seeing half of what.
But at the same time, I feel like it works better.
It does. Like, the mystery. It adds more mystery to it.
Like, a lot of times with films like that, I think, like, oh, I wish I could see those missing scenes. I feel like putting them back in.
Yeah, and then
ruins.
When you see them, you're like, oh, this sucks.
Like, the Thin Red Line, the original cut for the Thin Red Line.
There's not enough cut scenes from that one.
The Thin Red Line was originally, like, a 6-hour long movie, and that's a movie I would love to sit down and just watch those whole 6 hours.
But yeah.
This movie, I think it's perfect at the, it's like 2 hours and 1 minute.
Okay.
Even considering that, like, what I just said about, or what Dave just said about Jeffrey Beaumont witnessing a rape and doing nothing about it and just watching it, that being cut... Without having seen that cut scene, I would have never made the connection that he enjoys watching crime happen.
Yeah.
I would have thought of his initial viewing of Dorothy Valance and Frank Booth being his first foray into voyeurism, whereas it's already been established, if we saw the original cut, that this is his thing.
Right. I mean, there's something about him that feels a little creepy.
There is. He does the chicken walk, remember?
He steals those fucking keys without even thinking twice. You know what I mean?
That's
like, he's
true.
Doing something weird
I
from
also
the
think
get-go.
That's part of that's just Kyle MacLachlan as an actor. Well, he has a sort of quirky nature.
Kyle MacLachlan is a strange man.
I love Kyle MacLachlan.
He's great in Sex and the City.
I've never seen any of that.
He's wonderful in Showgirls.
he's a great sort of weird actor. He does these weird sort of things that other actors
very
don't do.
Strange instincts.
I love
very strange.
A lot of the cast, I just love. I love Laura Dern. I love Laura Dern in general, but
she's
love her
great.
In this. She's great.
She plays the world's oldest high schooler.
I mean, we already said Dean Stockwell was really great.
Yeah.
I mean, it's and even people just in the background who don't do much.
Brad Dourif.
Brad Dourif doesn't have, like, really do anything, but he's just great, like, scenery. And Jack Nance is in it. He was the star of Eraserhead.
Yeah.
He's, again, one of the random.
He's also in Lost Highway.
He's in all of Lynch's films until Jack Nance's death.
Yeah. Why didn't he appear in any films after that?
Well, they couldn't, you know, he was busy in the afterlife.
But yeah, he plays that strange character that.
He kind of looks like Brian Doyle Murray, where he's like in a Caddyshack.
Yeah.
He's got like the hat and the mustache.
All right. Well, I'm going to watch it again. And I enjoyed it. And I think I enjoy it more now mulling it over. It's
definitely something you have to, you know, chew, spit out, pick it up off the ground, chew it again, spit it out, throw it at somebody, put it back in your mouth, hand it to your neighbor, put it back in your mouth, put it in his mouth, and then chew it a little more.
I mean, this is, it's a... You know, to use the bluntest term, but it's a weird movie, and to just sit down and watch this cold, I could definitely see. Like, I guess I'm biased because I've seen it before, and I'm used to the weirdness.
There's no need to brag. We're all in this together.
I can't imagine.
I also have really big muscles. Do you guys want to see them? But
that scene is great. I just kept imagining like a 45-year-old couple accidentally going into this movie.
Yeah, like your grandparents.
Yeah.
Like, oh, Blue Velvet, I remember that song, and they wander into the theater.
Speaking of which, I have a memory of this film from when I was a kid. I think I'm going to say this was 1989 or so, and my mom rented a movie that a friend had recommended that she watch, and she made me go to bed because it wasn't a movie that kids should watch.
No.
And so I obsessed over what this movie was all night long.
That's what happens when your parents say, you can't watch this.
And so as soon as she woke up the next morning, I asked her, Mom, what was the movie about that I couldn't see? And she said, oh, it was stupid. It was terrible. It was about this guy who finds a missing ear.
And right away, I'd be like, I have to see this.
And I thought, I did. I was like, oh, that sounds really interesting. And I was really young in 1989. I think I was 15.
Oh, no.
I'm kidding. Yeah. I'm not that old. But yeah, my mom was one of those people. And in 1989, my mom would have probably been about 73 years old. So Jeff. This was not her type of movie. I'm just putting a timeline on my life. Is everyone following?
Jeff's Benjamin Button.
I have the same exact memory, but the movie was Philadelphia.
Ah.
I actually have the same exact memory, and the movie was Reservoir Dogs. So there you have it. All of our parents kept us from
Why
movies.
Was my mom putting both of you to bed? That's the curious thing.
I don't
thing.
Know, but we were just all at your house, and your old mother was there.
And at this point, it was 93.
It was a nursing home for some reason that you lived in.
Well, now that story's out of the bag, shall we?
We all grew up together in Jeff's nursing home.
Yeah. Shall we recommend some movies?
Yes.
Cut to print the film. Movie recommendations.
Well, what do you have to say for yourself, Dave?
We have so many, I forget them all.
Now they're catching me off guard because I don't know which one you're going to play.
Oh, man.
All right. Who wants to go first this week? I guess I'll go.
Yeah, do it.
Okay. My pick this week is a film that came out in 2008. It's not a particularly great film. I'm not going to say it's great, but it's interesting, and the premise is good, and it surprised me at how much I actually liked it. It's called JCVD.
Oh, with Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Yes, that's what the JCVD stands for, everyone.
I meant to see this, but I never got around to
it. Same here. And it was playing on one of the premium channels. I guess it was Showtime. And so I figured, you know what? I'll just watch it now since I'm not doing anything else. And I ended up really liking it. What this film is about is Jean-Claude Van Damme plays himself. And he is going through a custody battle with his wife. And he decides to...
This is purely fictional?
Yeah, it's fictional.
No, this really happened.
He's broke.
Just like the movie Time Cop, this really happened.
All his money's going into this custody battle. So he goes back to his home city of Belgium, home country of Belgium, and he gets involved in a bank robbery gone wrong. He goes into the bank to make a withdrawal, and the bank is already in the process of being robbed. So he becomes a hostage, but the bank robbers make him act as though he's the one robbing the bank, and they make him demand all this money from the police.
They know he's Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Everybody knows he's Jean-Claude Van Damme. That's why they make him do it. And it becomes this big press thing. And there's some...
When do the karate kicks begin?
There are none. Ugh. There is one, but it's done by somebody else trying to impress Van Damme. It's funny. It's interesting. And you won't even believe this. I didn't believe it. And that's part of why I'm picking it. Jean-Claude Van Damme is actually a pretty good actor.
I've heard that. He's yes, really good in this.
Because this is a foreign film. It's it's not in English. And that appears to be the problem with Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Right.
He can't act when he does an English accent. It just once the curtain has been lifted, he's just wasted in English movies. But when he's speaking his native tongue, he's fantastic. He's actually acting. It's great. He's there's just a lot to this character, even though he's playing himself. There's heart to it. There's heartache to it. It's a really, really interesting movie, and it's not great. But it's good, and I think everybody should see it.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to finally sit down and watch this.
It's ambitious.
Nice.
I'll say that. So, yeah, that's my pick. It's 2008's JCVD.
Heineken! Fuck that shit! Pass Blue Ribbon!
Who's next?
I'll go. I will pick a short film this week, which we don't do that often. So, I don't know about you guys, but I'm not keen on short films.
I like Capri Pants.
For some reason, I don't know if it's like a bias or what, but when someone's like, oh, did you see this? In a lot of film festivals, they have short films, and I'm just like, I can't be bothered to
not a big
sit
fan.
Through this.
See, I always, I'm the same way. I don't want to watch them, but when I do, I more than not enjoy them.
I feel like they're hit or miss, because sometimes they'll be really good, and sometimes it's like, boy, this is student art bullshit, yeah. Turn it off.
Yeah.
So every once in a while, I try and, you know, be a little more open-minded to watch a short film. So this is a short film. It's called Widow, and it's from a director named Carl Mueller. And it's 8 minutes long, and it's it's a, I guess you could call it a horror movie, even as a short, and it's creepier than 90% of full-length horror movies I've ever seen. So it's a very simple premise. I'll read the plot description. A pair of high-tech back-alley psychics begrudgingly show a wealthy client a raw audio-visual feed that may or may not be straight from her late husband's experience of the afterlife. So it's a very simple – there's only three people in the whole movie. It's a very simple premise. There's a lot of really cool, unique editing that makes this, you know, stand out from just like a bullshit short movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's this woman. She's going to see these psychics. And she's just, she's trying to get footage of her dead husband from the afterlife. And there's one point it cuts to the lab where these guys work out of, and the husband's body is wrapped up in these trash bags, and there's these wires coming off of it. And it's a disturbing movie. And there is a, it ends on a jump scare, which I normally don't like, but it's so fucking well done.
Okay.
That after watching it, it gave me the chills. That's how well done this is. So. I've sent Jeff the link. When he puts the post together, he can link to the actual video, and you at home can watch this short film. It's called Widow.
Widow?
Yes.
When did it come out? This year?
It came out 3 years ago.
Okay. All right.
Heineken! Fuck that shit! Pabst Blue Ribbon!
So it's like Lazarus Effect. That's what you're trying to
No, think. It's not.
Boy, I hope not.
So what we do with these recommendations is like sometimes try to think of a movie that you liked. And then you rewatch it, like you're like, man, I liked that movie. Right? So I thought of one. Finally, I was like, I want to recommend that movie, but I got to rewatch it because you can't recommend it without having seen it in 10 years.
Right. Fraggle Rock. That's not a movie. It's a show.
The movie I thought of was 2005's Lord of War, starring Nicolas Cage.
I remember this,
which I loved when I first saw it,
right.
And now I watched it again the other night, and it is not very good.
I remember it being a little, I guess clunky is the word. There's some good ideas in it.
Yeah. But it's like, so on the rewatch, it ended up being one of those bad movies that are enjoyable to watch.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's not it's not a bad movie. Like it is a bad movie, but it's not like a waste of time.
Okay.
It follows this guy, Yuri Orlov, who's, Nicolas Cage apparently is, part of the Ukraine now. I don't know.
I think he's like Russian, or he lives in Little Odessa in the New York.
He does a very, I don't know if it's a convincing Russian because I don't speak
I'm
Russian.
Going to say no.
I remember Nicolas Cage being good in this. This is one of those times where Nicolas Cage is like, oh, I'll act.
Yeah.
Let me show you I can act.
He's doing a decent job. Jared Leto is not doing his job at all, so he's like pulling a distraction away from Nicolas Cage. Jared Leto plays his younger brother, who's
the Joker, I believe, is the
Anyway, Yuri Orlov is this, he just somehow starts getting into the gun running business. It doesn't even make any sense when I was rewatching it, but it just slowly builds, and it, the thing I don't like about it is that the whole movie is Nicolas Cage reading a monologue, like he's narrating the entire thing, and it gets tiresome, but there are some moments where that's good, but
it feels like that's something like they had a test screening and then the audience didn't like it. And so they were like, add a narration. So it's more clear.
Well, yeah. Nothing makes a movie better than narration telling me what I just saw. That's great.
This is directed by Andrew Niccol, the guy who directed Gattaca.
Right. He also wrote The Truman Show.
Yeah. So he has, which, you know, you can see some of that, both of those movies in this, the good and the bad. But it's worth watching for Nicolas Cage because he's solid in this, and you don't get to see that a lot.
Normally he's in a gas form.
Yes. He's a cloud.
So that's my first bad movie recommendation.
I wouldn't say it's the first.
No, I'd say Palo Alto was the first.
Yes,
bad one.
I think we were all thinking that.
All right, so what was that
2005's
called?
Lord of War.
All right.
Well,
that's our show.
Next week, we're going to be talking David Lynch's Mulholland Drive, which many people consider his best film. So we'll see how that turns out.
Yeah, we certainly will, won't we?
Yeah. So if you haven't seen that film, or if you haven't seen it in a while, catch up with it so you can listen in next week to see what the hell we're talking about.
Is Robert Loggia in that?
No, he's not.
Yes, no, he is.
Wait, Rob, are you in that?
Is he
I am. No, he's not in it. He's making things up.
God, Jeff.
I'm just talking nonsense. Yeah, so check us out on the internet. We are at cutprintfilm.com. Mm-hmm. We have reviews, interviews, editorials, movie news, breaking movie. We're breaking stories all the time. We just broke one the other day. I don't remember what it was. We break them so often, I forget what they are.
Don't ask me. I post them, and I don't even remember.
That's right. I think we broke Danny Glover was to play the new Spider-Man.
Yeah, you heard it here first.
But we also, this coming week, we'll have reviews for Will Ferrell's new movie, Get Hard.
Oh, no.
Oh, no, indeed, because I'll be seeing it.
Ugh.
I'll have a review for Noah Baumbach's new movie, While We're Young,
right,
which I already saw and enjoy.
I'll be seeing the 7-hour screening of Furious 7, so we'll have a review of that, too.
Yes.
It's about cars that go vroom vroom, I believe.
And how fast do they go?
We'll never know.
I assume we'll talk about all three of those next week, too.
Yeah,
so.
I would imagine, yeah. Or well, at least one of those movies. Guess which one? You'll have to tune in to find out. Probably Furious 7, though. So, yeah, we're also going to have reviews this week for White God, which is a story about a man and his horse.
Yes, no, it's not. It's about dogs, my favorite creatures on Earth.
My
so.
Apologies. and we'll have an indie film called Welcome to New York, which sounds interesting.
Oh, yes.
You can check out some of our good buddies over at yahoo.com. They're searching all Yahoo! Things the internet. Also, google.com, great things from Google. They have docs and sheets. You can also check out the Joystick Jerks at joystickjerks.com.
They're doing their March Madness right now, so
that's
head
right.
over there. I don't know what any of that means.
I don't even know what real March Madness is. Whatever. I'm a nerd.
That's when you drink too much mercury and you go insane forever.
Speaking of too much mercury, you should also listen to antifanboy.com. They're a website. They have comic stuff, pop culture stuff, all that sort of nerdy stuff that nerds like.
Yes. Nerdy nerds.
Nerds who can't get dates and have big glasses and pocket protectors.
And pop pimples all over their cheerios.
All over the mirror.
And don't forget next week, the Cutprint Film Mailman is coming.
That's right.
So,
ding dong, mail's here. Oh, good. It's a death notice. My father has passed away.
Jesus. I guess we have to go to the funeral.